Well, welcome to all of you to this event this evening in the Mad, Bad and Sad season, which explores the relationship between women, psychiatry, psychoanalysis, both historically and today. This evening we're incredibly privileged because not only are we going to be talking about one of my favourite subjects, bad girls, but we have Dr. Cleo Van Velsen with us, who is, I think, one of the most extraordinary forces in forensic psychiatry today, and also is a psychoanalyst, has trained in both sides of the profession. And right here also we have Estella Brandon, who has also worked on both sides of this profession. So it can be very interesting evening, I think. Cleo Van Velsen, as you can see, God, I mustn't move, is a consultant psychiatrist in forensic psychotherapy, and a member of the British Institute of Psychoanalysis. She's worked at the Maudsley, and she is now, Cleo, you're going to have to help me because I'm going to pull my glasses to read this because it's such a long title. She is now responsible clinician in the Personality Disorder Medium Secure Unit in East London. She's worked, as I said, at the Maudsley, at Great Ordnance Street, among other places. She also worked for a year in the Medical Foundation for the Care of Victims of Torture. So she now does all sides of the forensic circle, if you like, both assessments and treatment, and I fear also management. we're going to run this evening by her beginning with a 20-25 minute presentation of her field and its ins and outs, and then we're going to have perhaps a little conversation with me and questions from you. So prepare yourself. There are slides, so I may go down here so I can see you better.
Yes, thanks very much, Lisa, for that generous invitation, and thanks for inviting me. As Lisa said, I sort of straddle a borderline, really, that I work very much in a forensic psychiatric unit. It's a forensic personality disorder unit for men, and it's based on a sort of adaptive therapeutic community. So I get to use some of my psychoanalytic and psychotherapeutic training there. I see a lot of women in preparation for court reports, often mothers, some criminal and some civil. So that's my sort of background. And that I don't really like reading out papers, I suppose. I'm kind of in psychiatry, you don't sort of do that very much, and I hope that I can just say some things that will help people, I don't know, have some questions and discussion. When I was Googling violence by women, all I came up with was violence against women. And that the only hits I could get is if I put women who kill. And there's something that today that I'd like to explore to do with the kind of, perhaps all three aspects of the title, Mad, Bad and Sad, in varying degrees. And I wanted to say that, you know, already acknowledged as Estella, who's made her name in thinking about perversion of violence and taken forward also by Anna Motz in her Psychology of Female Violence. And that, you know, there are, and I, you know, I hope that some of that will come in, although I might take a slightly different route, just to sort of remember certain things. For example, with what Estella argued was that that the idea that perversion of women didn't exist was false, that it took a different form, and that it took the form of attacks against the body and the products of the body, babies. And that it's very interesting because if we think about deliberate self-harm, the rate amongst women is much higher than men, but if you think about completed suicide, the rate is higher than men. So they're a slightly different phenomena. And a colleague of mine once started a talk by saying, what is the most striking fact about violence to others is that it's mainly committed by men. And there are all sorts of reasons that we could think about that. I'm quite in favour of a sort of an attachment explanation to do with that there's something fundamental about the journey that a boy makes in development as opposed to a girl. And the image I always have is a sort of, a mother walking along the side of a canal with the boy in one hand and the girl in the other, and at some point the boy has to cross that canal and make an identification with a father, with a man. And that crossing of the water really creates a vulnerability that's always going to be significant in their lives. And that, whereas the girl in some ways can remain in identification with the mother, which is why I think their form of violence is often more internally directed rather than externally. That's sort of a bigger discussion. But I think because when often people talk about violence, they don't, why is the gender difference? Women are abused, men are, but somehow it takes these different forms, and I just wanted us to keep that in mind. And I thought I'd start with some statistics, really, from the National Confidential Inquiry into Suicide and Homicide in 2001. The more recent findings are still very much the same. And that these are rather dense, but I've highlighted, I thought, the important points. So we look at the number of homicides, and that 90% of the perpetrators were men, given a sort of ratio of 9 to 1. And that's highest in younger people. So that is really what we're thinking about when we're thinking about violence. Most victims were also young. 4% were aged under 1, of whom a quarter were killed by female perpetrators. So this then links to the notion that the violence is around self and product of self. When women were the perpetrators, the victim was their own children in a quarter of cases and their spouse partner in about a third of cases, whereas there's a higher level of strangers when you think about male homicide. Stranger homicides by women are rare. What's the point from that slide? When you think about the outcome in court, 10% of perpetrators were found guilty of manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility or infanticide. Infanticide is a very interesting phenomenon. It's an alternative charge, it's not a defence. And it comes from the 19th century when the notion was that mothers were kind of feeble in the first year after birth. So up to a year and a day, you can go for an alternative charge of infanticide. It's not a defence, though, it's an alternative charge, and it's often used. They don't have it in the States. So you get much harsher sentences for mothers in the States. So there we are. Diminished responsibility is an abnormality of mind such as to substantially diminish responsibility for the crime, for the killing. It's different to a sort of insanity plea, which basically is much more total, i.e. that somebody didn't know what they were doing, they didn't know that it was wrong, etc. And this was a way in between, really, of finding a way of taking into account a psychiatric history, but not totally saying that that took away responsibility. And if you're found guilty of manslaughter on grounds of diminished responsibility, you can either go to hospital or to prison. So you can still get a prison sentence even though you've got a diminished result. But what's interesting is that women are much more likely to get a hospital disposal than men. So women are much more likely to be sent to hospital than to prison. And that over half the men, but only 10% of the women, are convicted of murder. So it's one of those sort of interesting fields where actually you could say that perhaps men have had a rawer sort of deal. And this is because of the difficulty in acknowledging, I think, sometimes aspects of female aggression and violence. But it's also true that women perpetrators were more likely to have symptoms of mental illness at the time of the offence, more likely to have been in contact with services in the previous year, and more likely to have a diagnosis of affective disorder. So there is some difference very much in the profile of women and men who are convicted of homicide. Before I move on to the next slide, I just want to say I think that it's also important to remember that violence is not just located in men and women who are convicted of it. And that one of the things that I'm most interested in is how violence can be mobilised in many of us in the right social, cultural, political context. And it's just important to remember that. And I'll come back to that later. That notion that violence is not just isolated to certain people who've had certain sort of genetic inheritance plus experience, but that actually it takes sometimes surprisingly little to mobilise people into violence. And one of the, you know, things I liked so much about Lisa's book was that I can get very sort of caught up in the English-American experience, rather than thinking about experiences elsewhere, other cultures, and that's what I very much liked about your book. It made me think about that. So when I was thinking about an example, I found a paper, and it's about the women who were involved in the Rwandan genocide, which involved ministers and two nuns who were later convicted in Belgium and who took an active part in the genocide, both sort of locking people up, taking machetes to them, etc. And I just thought it was an interesting kind of reminder that I don't think those women probably had a mental illness or a disorder. That the violence occurred in a particular sort of context. And one of the women who she describes was one of the journalists who was on the radio saying, "Go kill the cockroaches." And so I thought, and this quote was quite nice. The woman as mother narrative is at its core an essentialist belief that a woman who is also a mother cannot perpetrate crimes during genocide because she's just that, a woman and a mother. And one of the people who is convicted didn't provide any other reasons in her defence other than, "I am a woman and I'm a mother, so I couldn't have done it." And I thought that was a nice echo, Stella, of your work. And that she describes a journalist as saying how the discourse around the women involved in this often resolves around their appearance, their nice dress, they look like an auntie, etc. And, you know, there's a different way of perceiving these people. And she went on to say that even some Rwandan NGO organisation maintain that women have a different nature to men. They are not violent. This old idea that somehow if women were in power, the genocide wouldn't have taken place. An essentialist argument, as she said, also made by some Western feminist theorists, who posit that men are inherently more warlike than women, and that the wars we have suffered are a result of male-dominated political and military systems. Now, that might be true, but it doesn't then extend to that somehow, if women were in charge, there'd be less violence. And that, you know, I was thinking about how, that when we think about tyranny, which is what happens in various of these places, you know, there can be domestic tyranny as well as external tyranny. And that the management of the domestic space by women has been tyrannical. It's a different scale, and it needs to be looked at differently, but that's important to remember. So I just wanted to, I thought that was an interesting sort of description of, to make us just think a little bit, that it's very important to remember how we in the West, which is basically basically a safe country, actually. You go nuts about things that are risky, but it isn't. And it allows us to say there are people in hospitals, the mad ones, and there are bad people in hospitals and in prisons, and they're the ones who we need to worry about because they are right. And that we don't then think about how violence can take different forms and how we could all be part of that. And a lot of the mothers that I see in cases for the family court, you know, in a way don't, it's as if they say to me, but doctor, you know, I'm a mother. I love my children. I love them. Doesn't stop you harming me. I saw a woman recently who had deprived her of this child of food. It was a very severe case of mistreatment. And when I talked to her, she just said, my children are dead. And she wasn't psychotic, but it was a sort of psychotic state of denial, because it was easier for her psychically to think that the children were dead than to think they weren't in her care because of what she had done to them. So when we think about services, we have maximum secure services. There's still a maximum secure service in Rampton Hospital up in Nottinghamshire. And the one in Broadmoor was closed and moved to Ealing. So those are the two maximum secure services in England. Very interesting, there's lots of paper written about the service in Broadmoor. And it was said that although the women's service at Broadmoor comprised sort of 10 or 20% of the population at Broadmoor, it produced 75% of incidents. And that there was a sort of terror of working with women because of especially the levels of self-harm. Then you have medium secure. So in the service I work in, the John Howard Centre, there's a woman's ward. And then there's low secure. And then there are the community mental health teams. And there are personality disorder services, not in secure settings, but in sort of community settings. For example, the Halliwick Day Hospital, where Anthony Bateman and Peter Fonagy worked and produce mentalisation-based treatment, but it's a day hospital, mainly for people with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, and they're mainly women. So thinking a bit more about personality disorder, the consistent finding has been that men get diagnosed with an antisocial personality disorder, they're bad. Women get diagnosed with a borderline personality disorder, they're sort of mad and sad. And sometimes it's quite interesting because you'll say, actually, I think this woman probably has a diagnosis of antisocial. Yeah. And this man might be borderline. So, and that it's a very, it becomes, sometimes it's less of a diagnosis and more of a description. Or a sort of labelling of somebody. I remember a trainee presenting somebody to me and he said, oh, you know, she's got a personality disorder. So I said, well, which one? Because there are 10 of them. And he couldn't answer, because really what he was saying is, I didn't like her. She freaked me out. And, you know, she's got personality disorder, which is less a description or a diagnosis than a sort of label. That women with borderline personality disorder can be thought of as sad. Severe borderline personality disorder, people have periods of psychosis, which are quite frightening, but they're self-limiting, they're not sort of so sustained, but there's a psychotic element often in their attachments. They become very preoccupied with who's with them or who's not and what happens if you lose somebody. And there is a great interest in traumatization. And that some people have argued that borderline personality disorder is just an adult version of post-traumatic stress disorder. that it's just the same thing. I don't quite agree with that, because I think it then means as if you have to say, so if somebody's got BPD, borderline personality disorder, they must have been abused. As if borderline personality disorder couldn't have other aspects that are part of its etiology. Thinking back, we were looking back around the exhibition, and again thinking back to Lisa's book about, you know, Charcot, about his interest in hysteria. And hysteria has a sort of, it's a tough word to use, because it can sound sort of, I don't know, both judgmental and belittling in some way. But in my experience, more and more I'm convinced that it's a significant feature in many of the women that I see. A sort of rather histrionic, dramatizing presentation. And so somebody, perhaps with the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, you know, will be saying, you know, I'll hurt myself, I'll kill myself if you don't admit me, or if I don't get my children back or something. And when you're with them, you feel that you're being sort of battled with, really, that it's a threat. And again, going back to the idea, it's the use of their own body as a threat to you. And I can tell you, working in a forensic unit, most of my patients are high-harm men. They've committed murders, rapes, and manslaughter, that sort of thing. What is it that really upsets nursing staff? Self-harm. So it's a very powerful weapon. And Jess, who's our art therapist, will know that there are discussions sometimes. So suddenly we're in a kind of psychodynamic unit, and people will say, you know, X is threatening self-harm. You have to do a mental state. Regression right back. The doctor, psychiatrist, do a mental state, please, and sort it out. The idea that it could be thought about in terms of an act of threat and violence, which we deal with all the time. But suddenly, in that moment, it isn't a threat of violence, it's illness, it's madness. And I have to deal with it somehow, and do a mental state, not that that does anything very magical. And it's a very fine line sometimes, that. But I see a lot, and then the other day I saw a woman who had a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, and who was also described as making all these sorts of kinds of threats a lot of the time, and I've seen many women who do that. And when I went into the room, I really thought, this is a different being. This was not somebody who was threatening violence. I thought, I realized how, although I see many, many people, that I don't often see somebody that I think could die. Because it wasn't in that, there was a sense, then I sort of, you used to go back to the metaphor, I think, this is kind of real illness, and I have to do something about it, to protect her. It was a very striking, just sort of reminding me, actually, because I work so much with a different type of self-harm. And the histrionic, I do feel is important, and I hardly see it diagnosed by anyone but me. and I think, but this, you know, just that sort of dramatizing quality that can be so important. As I said, I've talked about, you know, the whole link between sexual abuse and borderline personality disorder, which, of course, there's a significant association. I just worry sometimes that we become detectives who have to, that's the only explanation, is a particular type of abuse, particularly sexual, rather than it perhaps being thought about in more general terms to do with more subtle interactions with parents. But also that we know from research that a significant aspect of temperament is inherited. There is a significant genetic contribution to personality disorder. And some of the more recent research is fascinating. What they call G times E, the G times E, is the very complex sort of that you'll be born with a predisposition to developing certain kind of problems, and that if the environment is good enough, you can be protected. But if it's not, then you can go on to develop the disorder. I think the nature-nurture debate is an old one, that it's, of course, both, and that we sometimes won't know why somebody is as disturbed as they are. And that we just have to sort of manage with that not knowing and get on with it. It's the same with the men that I see. There are syndromes such as battered wife syndrome. I have some problems with that. You know, it applies to women who perhaps kill a spouse in the context of long-term abuse. I think it's a medicalization of something that could be understood as, you know, differently and as understandable. But sometimes the pressure you're on as an expert witness is find illness rather than explain what might have happened. Right? And that's quite a complicated position you're in, because if you can say it's an illness called a syndrome, then that will that could sort of have a better result for the person. But I do feel that it perhaps means that we don't explore feelings in women to do such as hatred, the desire for vengeance, even instrumental violence sometimes. Quite often when I'm in court, I'll say something like, or in my reports I'll say, so I've seen a woman who's been very violent. I saw a woman who was so preoccupied with her video games that the two dogs just died of starvation in the house, and the children were crawling around, picking things up off the floor to try and eat. And there was a very marked sort of wish to explain it. And what I said is, just do a thought experiment. If that was a man, what would we be thinking? If it was a man that had done it. And the other way around as well. That there is quite a sort of powerful wish to explain it in terms of disorder. And sometimes I get referred women and I think, why have they referred her to me? There's no evidence of any mental health problems in the past. There's no disorder ever been described. She's been found to have hurt her child. Why do I have to see them? And then the instructions in the letter say, there's a wish that I could explain it and also manage the risk. And I kind of think, I can't. I'm interested in cutting, in self-harm, the meaning of it.
Is that you? I can't believe what's going on today. I'm so sorry. I'll probably become a grandmother or something. I'll turn it off. Please go on, Claire. Please, pay no attention. It's ridiculous. Yeah.
So, if we think about what I would call cutting, sort of self-harming by cutting yourself. I remember many years being presented with a case of a woman in a special hospital who had carved the letters death into her forehead. And there was quite a sort of powerful conversation between the few of us that were discussing it. Because I thought that she was cutting the treatment, that she was saying death to the treatment because of the way she was behaving. Other people thought that that was an expression of despair to do with her past. And I suppose the truth is it was a mixture of it. But that I do think there's something very powerful about cutting. There was an ward that was set up at the Maudsley some years ago, because as we know, if somebody cuts themselves, then the idea is that if you kind of immediately go and say, why did you do that, and you go and to sort of tidy it up, you reinforce it. because it elicits a kind of caregiving. So this ward decided that instead of doing that, they would allow cutting. And so that they would ignore it. And I was consulting and I said, no, there's no way I'm sitting with somebody who's cutting herself in front of me. I'm just not doing it. Because she's doing it to me. Rather than just, it didn't work, actually. It was because it just kind of became, rather sort of florid, and I thought it meant, it ended up with, I thought, the patients being very cruel to the nursing staff, because they were the ones who had to sit there and endure it. And I suppose that, you know, my training as a psychoanalyst, is that, Estella and I have talked about this, is that I am interested in the kind of negative transference, in understanding the destructiveness and naming it. That I'm not a mother, I'm not going to reparent, I want to put things into words so that it can be thought about and understood. And that's how I work, really. Now you have to be thoughtful about that and how you do it, but that's kind of what has always, I thought, informed my work, and that it can be quite a relief for someone, for a woman, to have a slightly different kind of approach. So rather than saying, what's the matter, what's the matter, why don't you tell me, you say, so quite often I'll say somebody in where the crying is massive, you're just weeping. And it stops you having a conversation. And so what's happened in the past is people, you know, have been extremely gentle so that they don't trigger the tears. I find it's been quite helpful to say, I think the crying has stopped a conversation happening, and I know you're distressed, but I'm going to keep talking through you. Because I think it's important that we actually just do talk about it. And it can be quite containing. People will stop crying. So it's, that's a sort of way of thinking about, in psychoanalytic terms, thinking about what's going on, what is happening, what are they doing to me as the therapist who's there to sort of try and understand something. One of my patients once said to me, a woman I saw for many years, she had a manic depressive psychosis, she said, all you do is look for trouble. And I said, yeah, I do. That's my kind of job. And it means that there are certain types of illness or diagnoses that I can't work with very well. So, for example, when it comes to ME, chronic fatigue syndrome, where I think you have to have a different technique, you have to get alongside and make it. I'm not so good at that, because what I'm interested in is this tussle. Separated in hospitals. I think this is interesting. In recent years, there's been a big outcry about men and women having to share facility. And I was talking to a consultant who, Susan Isles, who worked at Baldwin, and sort of from the 80s and 90s, and she said, we fought hard to get some mixed events. For people locked up in a special hospital for years, it was considered, for a time, progress that they could meet and mix together. And now it's like never the twain should meet. And often the assumption is that, of course, that the women will be victimized and upset and by the men. I did a group with men who were on at the John Howard Center, just at the tail end of a sort of shared war. And I remember, and those men had a diagnosis of mental illness, and they came in. I remember one of them saying to me, "Doctor, the women, they're so frightening." And this is a sort of, and he said, "I have to go and hide in my room because they just, and then they shout, and they, and it was just such a very, you know, his experience was actually being quite terrifying. And that it's just never as simple as, you know, the kind of nasty men. And I wish there was a bit more mixing. You know, because I think that's what we should do. And that's kind of ordinary, and try and manage it better. But to sort of not play into a particular split version of how people are. There's, as you know, has been a lot of controversy about the issue of factitious disorder by proxy, or that's called Munchausen by proxy, and that, you know, they are cases that I am careful about which ones I take on. Not because I don't think I can do the, you know, do the assessment, but because I'm scared of being attacked by complaints, and whatever, by this Mothers Against Munchausen organization, which is, you know, which sort of really did for the careers of some people in this field. And that what's a paradox is that in all my years of working in a forensic setting with men, I mean, I've had occasional hairy moments, but I have never been subject to the kind of attacks that people who work, for example, Simon Wesley, who's Professor Sir Simon Wesley now, but he made his name working with the field of ME, and he had to stop it because of the level of threat, because he suggested that there might be a psychological dimension to this disorder. And that's a very, and he described a mother coming up to him and tapping him in the chest and saying, "I hope you and your children die." I've never had that. Actually, there's a sort of straightforwardness about my guys that I sort of appreciate. And so I'm just going to stop there, because I just hope that that will kind of provide some place for discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Cleo. I'm sorry about all these noises coming from me. I feel like I'm doing. I don't know why it's doing that, but I'll put it down here and it'll stop. And I'm sorry about that. Before I ask you any questions, could I just have a show of hands about how many people in this room actually work in either forensic or psychiatric spaces? Okay, so a few of you, not all of you. I only ask because, you know, I don't, and I don't know quite what kinds of questions you might be interested in if you do share the same experiences as Cleo. Okay, so the first thing I want to ask you is, what you say about now is also true about women historically within the definitions of madness or badness, and there's always been an unwillingness to say that women can be really bad. One would prefer some kind of mental condition, we'd like to categorize it there, because I think it's probably better for society to have women thought of as being able to encapsulate some of the things we want that lead towards a good life, i.e. virtue or goodness or even frivolity and pleasure. So on that spectrum. So, but, I mean, that, in my historical work, that's always been the case. I find it interesting that we still want it to be the case, even though there have been so many changes in other ways in women's lives. And why do you think that is? And how do the women within your forensic practice reflect that? I mean, do they want a diagnosis as well?
It's an interesting question. I think it sort of depends at what stage they are. And it also, of course, is slightly distorted. So if, by the proceedings, so for example, I might see a young mother who, and children being taken into care because of her poor care, which is often linked to the poor care she received, of course. And I'll say, look, you know, I think you've got trays of this, you know, and that, I think we can try and understand what happened, and my recommendation in the report will be that they should seek some kind of psychological intervention to help continue with the work that my report has started. And they go, yeah, doctor, I think that's, that makes sense. But it's as if by my writing the report, then you come to court 18 months later, and nothing has happened. So, and I often re-see somebody prior to the court hearing, and I, you know, I'll say, so what did you think of my report then? Oh, I haven't read it. And, I said, but, you know, and that is if it's just for the court, it's not for them. Even though I now make it a practice at the end of every interview to say, I want you to read this report. It's about you. You might not agree with all of it, but you need to read it and to think about it. And then I'll say, so, you know, how's the referral gone for? And often I'm happy for my report to be used as the referral for psychotherapy or counselling even. And, oh, it hasn't happened because social services didn't do it and X didn't do it. I said, but it's your treatment. And then you go into court, and then they get very upset because I've said, well, I can't say that the risk has gone down. Even though often by the time I'm actually in the court, they say, well, now I've got no assessment of risk. And I don't know, so I don't know how helpful it is. And then you have other cases. I saw one recently of somebody who was in a, she'd had six children, it was terribly. It was so, and she'd had a relationship with a 14-year-old boy at the age of 37, which again, you know, she said, well, he bullied me into me. Again, that's one of my thought technique, you know, my mind experience was that that was a 37-year-old man and a 14-year-old girl. No one would be suggesting that she didn't have to take this out to take responsibility. Anyway, off she went, and I was amazed. She found herself a forensic psychologist. She got herself onto the free IDAP training. And I saw her 18 months later, and she was a very different person. And why she could, even though I would have thought she'd be the last person, she felt so broken down. But yet, there was also, she had some good people around her, but she also, sometimes it's, when you do, if you do an assessment, you can see with some people that it's for the first time they feel a bit interested. And that, because otherwise it's all the lawyers talking about this and that, and, you know, sending instructions and documents as if it's nothing to do with anything. But so I don't know why. I don't think I've answered your question.
I mean, when you describe that here, it feels to me a little bit as if part of the process of assessment is actually an attempt at education about the self.
Yes.
Which has never happened. I mean, it's really a kind of holding up a mirror and saying, insight, insight, insight. But insight is difficult, isn't it?
Yes,
I mean, it's a...
And you know...
It's almost an impossible process. It's a difficult process.
And interestingly, it's not always the most important thing in recovery, but somehow taking some advice and kind of taking on board the thing and taking some action, then the insight comes through that.
Process.
It's a process, and that but it's very, it is very it's very interesting, or you know, and you'll see somebody who, you know, I saw her with her first baby, and now with her sixth, and that sort of, or you're in proceedings and you sort of think you've got a good plan and that with some care they can be rehabilitated with the baby and the child. And then they get pregnant again. And suddenly you're left thinking, well, she might just have managed one, but too many. And it is a very, and I do think sometimes the system doesn't always help. So, for example, social workers can be extremely, I just think what they have to do is so interesting. But they can become very preoccupied, say, that a mother has had a history of abuse. And I feel like saying, but you know, that's not what we need to explore now. I need to help them get on with their lives and think about actually reinforcing healthy defences, not being a bit over preoccupied. That can come later.
That's part of cultural phenomenon. Mm. That's where our own larger social preoccupations feed into the way the practice takes place. Mm. So before they looked for abuse, they looked for other things. Psychiatrists, for example, forensic services. They weren't concerned about that. But the kind of work that took place probably had, I mean, the process that it might have had a similarity, I don't know. That's odd. I wanted to ask you two more things before opening up. One is to do with this whole thing of self-harm and why it is, and I've heard this from other people who work in psychiatric services, that they find women so much more difficult than men to deal with as medics in that situation, and why self-harm is so distressing.
It's true for men as well. My unit, one person who severely self-harms causes such a lot of anxiety. And that I think it's because people can't quite understand why it feels like such an attack on them. And because the language, this is my view, and other people disagree, is that, it's about letting feelings out. Maybe that's a bit of it. But it's about violence. And what people get really upset about is naming. So, I think that if you can't sort of name it for what it is, then it actually is very distressing. And it doesn't quite make, for example, a few years ago, somebody who had it was a very severe, he cut himself a lot, and he cut himself, and I had only just started there. So what happened was that they just took everything out of his room, as if that was going to stop him arguing. It becomes very concrete, and it really broke the therapeutic in a way that was very harmful, and I just find it very concerning. We'll take this up. What are you going to do? One of the things we try and do is that people have to dress themselves, their wounds themselves, and sort of take that on. But it is a very, people get very, and the levels of self-harm in this maximum secure hospital was really frightening. For people, it was playing with death in a very powerful way, putting things down the throat, really bad self-harm, and it upsets people very much.
So it's my last question before you. Okay. Is there anything that the GPs have valid, and there was a way in which they could sit together and think about patients and somehow shore themselves up? What happens in the forensic services psychiatry? Because it seems to me, from the outside, that it's something that I just couldn't do. I mean, I just wouldn't be able to cope with. And yet you cope with it all the time, and other people in this room cope with it all the time. So how do you shore yourself up to the task?
Well, I certainly sometimes think I would never have done this if I hadn't done an analytic training. I do sometimes worry about colleagues, and I think I don't know quite how people sustain this. Because at least that taught me something about stepping back and kind of trying to create some thinking space. And at one point I was going to be a forensic psychiatrist, and then I thought, bloody hell, why am I so interested in above averagely violent and perverse men? You know, I better find out something about that. And so I got distracted down the analytic route. Because I think it is a relevant question, actually. And it can be very unmodified and unprocessed, but what people have to deal with. We try and do it, but I think we are unusual in the amount of supervision we have. We have a staff group facilitated by an external psychotherapist. We have a reflective practice group that's facilitated by the psychotherapist within the unit. I facilitate a nurse supervision group. But, of course, you get the problems, people avoiding it or whatever. I do think there needs to be some kind of reflective process. But we have just started something which I think is quite useful, is that not just a kind of traditional reflective practice group of people, but also once a month to have a bit of teaching on perhaps on something new. You know, that's been, so for example, we're going to do a session on deliberate self-harm. So actually trying to incorporate some of that. The nice guidelines on deliberate self-harm are, I think, very disappointing. I don't know if anyone has read them. But basically they say, well, you know, create a good therapeutic alliance. And you think, but that's the... It's getting there and it's so hard. You know, of course, if I've got a great therapeutic alliance, then, you know, I'm not having to... You know, it. The whole point is, especially with people who, say, have got to self-harm, is that every time they cut, they are cutting the alliance. And you have to work with that.
So that was going to be my last question, but I'm going to wait for the others. But keep it in mind. I want to know what you do when you walk into the room to help set up therapeutic alliance. Okay, questions from you.
Yes,
there and then there. Please.
What we found is that anger, it used to be sort of thought that that was a key thing, but it isn't really, because everybody gets anger. And so the anger management courses that traditionally were applied, say, in prisons, they don't actually, they're not very effective. What we're interested in is violence. So that, and that it, I think it's important to formulate it in that way, because I can't take people's anger away. What I'm, is, you know, I'm, what we're interested in is working with the destructiveness of the violence. And anger is not particularly, you know, it's not specific, because it's everybody is angry, not everybody is violent. And of course, some people are more angry than others. You know, I'm a pretty irritable old thing. You know, I think my level of anger is higher than quite a lot of my colleagues. But I think that's kind of within. So I think we have moved away from sort of anger management to violence, to managing violence. Well, it can be a mixture. It can be anger. It can be sadism. It can be frustration, it can be hatred. So you want to be more specific, because anger isn't a...
It could be pleasure, too.
Yeah, well, sadism, gratification. It can be.
So I'm going to take another question here, and then you as well. Mm-hmm.
But I think that, and that, you know, I think, and that varies, doesn't it, from person to person. It might be that you have somebody who's cruel and withholding as a mother, and the, you know, you inculcate that sense of hatred. Then you might have somebody who's very smothering, you know, and actually they have to fight to get away. So I think that sort of, you want to kind of trace out more individually. I think attachment theory is, you know, and of course it's the absolute flame of the month. and I think it's quite useful. I don't think, myself, it goes quite far enough in understanding destructiveness, which is what interests me. And I'm a sort of Melanie-inclined independent, I suppose. So I do have a view about the death instinct and sort of what's kind of there as base material, which I think links with kind of modern love. You come into this world as someone, and that there is that. And I don't think attachment theory quite has got the subtlety of that, but it's a very helpful and useful way. And I certainly think that the mentalization-based treatment has been very useful in helping us think about our techniques to move away, for example, from a very analytic, you are feeling this, which just can make people feel that you're just pushing something into them.
Do you use mentalization?
Well, I mean, it was interesting because I went to the course and I thought, well, I was doing some of that anyway. Because I think you have to modify your technique. So I use a lot of analyst-centered interpretation. So not you are doing this, but, you know, I experience you as trying to shut me up, so, rather than you are doing it. So that you try and therefore not make people feel quite so sort of, that, you know, it's too much for people sometimes. It can make you feel very alienated and angry, actually, and they just think, who are you, you know, reading my mind, who do you think you are? And it's very important that. And I was very interested when I did the anatomization to sort of realise that actually over the years some of my techniques had sort of shifted that way. Stella.
Thank you very much. Now, no, because I have some questions that we should be working with you today. And we out now, or it is very soft, because it's a political correct PC. So now everybody is sort of united, all the language is united. So, some of them do not have our best friends, maybe, most of that. And some of them are very psychopaths. They call it rapist, serial rapist. The borderline personality disorder. I said, well, it's a psychopath. I'm sorry, the way he's talking, where is care? He's so clearly and plain about what's going on. And so, then somebody comes and says, you know, this now, this all this, he's now a graduate. And you know, he's talking about the stuff like that. I know, of course, I call it inmate. This now has had a treatment of 2 years with somebody who wants to go in the waterworks, and now he goes the other way. Did you know that?
From treatment?
Yes. So they come and you call them to the other way, it has come. So it is very extraordinary the amount of softness that we are applying in the coercive setting, which are taking us completely away from the reality of the past. We are talking about that. Of course, the anger is here, but of course we are all anger. That's a good. So, in a way, making one has a capacity to think. That's why the task of the therapy is to allow them to make them think before they are happy. There's an exaggerated really. I mean, I did some of it. To me, it was so clear, somebody who is violent. Very violent woman. They live in some sort of area, I don't know what sort of area that they have. The housing flats are down, and the people have very nice flats upstairs, with their, also with the sort of underground parking place. But, you see, we take the people, the upstairs downstairs. This woman then organized, they organized a neighbor's park. The neighbor's park is very renowned. We have this party and some of the upper class on the upper floor, they come down and they said to me, finish the party off, do something. This woman, she said to me, my permittee, she's in a group, and she said, I'm pained at the very end, she said something like, I did a horrible thing. What did she do? She went downstairs the following morning and recognized this monster and she went, shh, and then this terrible thing could be.
Ooh.
I'm sorry, but I just feel like I'm sorry. And she couldn't believe it. And I said, she could have killed that man that evening. She was able to wait until the following day and to do some anything. I will get the insurance to deal with that. I'm sorry. I mean, she didn't also avoid the sexual problem. So, I said it's something that she's been able to say to put the perspective and then to do something else to adopt it. But you see, we have to say upside down.
But it's also, I think there's a line, you know, because I think that there is a sort of idea, it's about how to, what the therapeutic alliance is, and that, you know, and in a way, the whole thing about softness is quite, it can be quite, because the patients need to know that you can manage it, and keep that, even if they've stopped thinking, that you might just about hang on in there and sort of work with it. And I remember a patient I had, she was very violent, and she was very sad, but she used to get herself, she used to work as a bouncer in a sort of tough lesbian club, and she'd also allow herself to get beaten up by men. It was very...
By men.
By men. And then, and she had a very sort of powerful kind of erotic transference to me, which was very hard to sort of manage at times. And the worst thing to do is to invite somebody into a relationship, then it gets too much because they do what they want, and then you say, well, it's too, you know, and you get, and that I think there was one time she burst into my office, and it was at the mausoleum. I had no alarm or anything in those days, and she pulled a filing cabinet in front of the door. So she barricaded me. So what do you do in that situation? Well, you don't say, I think you're feeling angry. or let's talk about this.
Right, because you're thinking, cabinet door, no, I don't like it.
And so what I said was, put it back! And she pulled it back. And that's what mentalization says, tricking the mind into thinking. And that you could say that's not, you know, but it was an... I think if you work with these patients, they need to know that you can sort of, you know, contain it, and that you can, not in a crazy, unsafe way, because after that, she wasn't allowed to see me in my office anymore. I had to see her in the emergency clinic, because she'd broken her alliance with me, and she had to... There were consequences for that. You know, she said, why can't I see you?
So how do you set up an alliance? Start with this patient before, take this patient, or take another one, before this happens?
I think it's an interesting one about technique, because there's a whole sort of dilemma. When you do an assessment, do you take sort of history and, you know, take a long time, or do you perhaps go in a bit more deep? Now, my style is, so for example, if somebody has seen lots of people, I might just start silently, which would fail you the membership of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, but, because my idea is to find where the anxiety is, where's that? That's my task as a psychologist. And then the person says, what do you want to know? Often what starts. And then I'll say to her, speak as if the person who needs to know something in this room is me. So what you're trying to do is to give the patient a very different experience early, in my view, early on. So they think, they might be anxious, but they think, that's new, and it's not just, Miss X, tell me about this, and tell me about... And they've given their history hundreds of times. And it's something about exploring the relationship.
Will it take to make jobs? Because they're very many people. People don't know what to do, and then you don't do anything to do. I'm not saying it's really funny, actually. It's really dangerous. But they're saying,
and that you're trying to sort of, and you know, if you get it a bit right, that's the third beginning of the therapy. Now, later on, I use a lot of humour later on, because I also think that's quite important, is that sort of, you know, like somebody said to me, it was very angry, he's being secluded, and he said, "Fuck off, you fucking fat cunt." And I said, "Fat." He just looked at me like, but you sort of want to, I think, because I just don't think I could survive my work if I didn't make stupid jokes. But I mean, it's, but also to sort of, I think part of the therapeutic alliance is about a patient having an experience of being enjoyed, some bit of them, that though you're looking. You know, as Freud said, to do surgery on one hand, you have to hold with the other, that you do have to have some enjoyment of this. And that the worst treatment outcomes, we know this from research, is where that isn't. Where, you know, it's somehow that therapeutic kind of alliance where patients just need to feel a bit enjoyed. And, you know, and I remember when I was in analysis and, you know, for some reason I've chosen independent analyst, although I think I had a fantasy about suddenly going to a Kleinian church and sort of being punished for my sins.
Yes.
And one of the things my analyst did was make jokes, and I thought, "You can't do that!" And it was a sort of, he taught me something about that, and how that kind of showing enjoyment, but keeping the boundaries, is actually very important. And that some of these patients, they've never been enjoyed very much, or been people who have something to offer and to give you. And that, it's a man, but it's a nice example. I did a clinical review. I have a patient who was really violent, lots of violence in his life, working up to a murder, I think. It was a bit, set fire to a house that the children were in. They were okay, but he actually had a mother who seemed okay. And he said to me, he said, you know, she always kept the line. And he doesn't want to see her because of the shame and because she doesn't want to see him, although they have phone contact. Anyway, we had a clinical review, and something in this man has flowered. And he has actually done quite a lot. And he's doing art therapy. Can believe he like, you know, he likes it. And I said to him late at lunchtime, I said, you know, what do you think your mother would have felt if she'd actually been in that room? And he said, it should have been his. And it was the first time he'd ever had an experience of a group of people saying that what he had to offer was good. And that is, and I said, so maybe she could think about inviting her. So that she could see him differently. And, you know, and I think a lot of the young mothers I've seen have never really been enjoyed as women, as daughters. You know, so they found a sexual kind of route out and parenthood. But I think that's quite. And so a couple of them, I went to see something. She was sent to prison. She kept telling me. And she went to a really good woman's prison. And she said, "I would have been great. Because people were nice to her, they looked after her, and she blossomed." And that I think one of the things you have to do in your work, and as it goes on, is to, there are some people where I think it's as if actually there's quite a lot of creativity in things quite close to the surface. And then there are others where it feels the destructiveness is pretty. Look, I think the psychopathic, the more psychopathic, where, and that, you know, psychotherapy can be very able to talk, but actually it's just some simple things like going to a decent prison. You know, actually.
Do you have a ranking for it?
Well, this was very nice. You go to it, it's got lovely gardens, there's a real sense of sort of, not like Holloway, which is hell, but, you know, it's, but I thought that was so fascinating that actually the one thing that we'd all try to avoid, which was her going to prison, happened to be the one thing that really helped. And she made friends, and she never...
It was much better than home. I mean,
it was much better than home. Yes.
So, I've got time for one more question, I think. This one. Anybody? Yeah. Okay. Clear. Oh, sorry.
The more maximums, the more psychopathic, what we know is that the higher the psychopathy score, the more genetically embedded that is. So that the, and it's one of the reasons I just think working in maximum schools is very hard. I think that the work that you have to do is too much. I want to work with people where there's a possibility for change. And that, but it is interesting, and, you know, the more narcissistic traits are the more inherited, the more antisocial. And a lot of the borderline are more clearly linked with environmental experience. There is a learning difficulty service. It's not something that I've done. They break my heart. When I go on to the learning disability ward, I just think, I've got these. They're too heartbreaking for me. And I think that I use words so much. But I have worked with someone. It's been very interesting and rewarding. It's been interesting because I have a niece that I'm close to who's got Down syndrome. And that's sort of been very interesting too. But I suppose I like patients that I can do battle with somewhere. Battle with the pathology with them. But, and I think some kinds of disorder, I just don't think I could do it.
Okay. Oh, yes.
I think it can be right, and I think the young boy who got in with this particular mother who had such a disturbed brain, I think he was absolutely pulled in way over his head in a way that she struggled to admit, and that there was a sort of feeling around because he was taller than her and strong, he wasn't sort of going to be affected. Because by the way, she lived in a small, close-knit community, and I think that I don't think she did him any favours at all. And I just think we have to think about that. I mean, I also think it can be a bit, sometimes I've seen a 19-year-old who's on the sex offenders register because he had a relationship with a 15-year-old, and I don't think, actually, in his case, he was a risk. I mean, he was an immature boy. You got caught up in, and again, what Stella was saying, sometimes you feel, can I say that? It's as if you're not allowed to say that a 15-year-old, you know, and, yes, for 10 years. That's his life gone. Oh, the
Caesarean. Complaint is the norm.
But it's also, it's not the social workers who put her into care, it's the court. So there was evidence in court, and I have felt quite cross about some of the commentary, because I think it's just an assumption that she's been a victim. And even a little thing saying, you know, why are you prioritising the this is in the Guardian, the safety and well-being of the child, rather than, you know, the mother's rights. And it's all the social workers took her into care, and that actually that 15 months have gone by because it's gone through the court. And I feel that there's a sort of, and again, I think if you think about a father, perhaps, who had a major mental illness and was acting very erratically around a new baby, there wouldn't have been quite the same comment.
It's the idea of the Caesar. It's the cut in order to... Yes, in order to... And so it has this kind of strange... I mean, I haven't read enough, so I don't actually know what happened.
Yes,
but it's that, you know, the baby Rob from the womb. It's got a Shakespearean overtone. It's the duff.
But maybe she was very frightening. Maybe she was very impossible to talk to. Maybe they tried to... We don't know.
Yes, exactly. I mean, I do think the Italian lawyer telling the Brits how awful they are also has news value.
Yeah, really, yes.
There was another question which I spot there, yes.
I think men are much more susceptible to shame. Yeah, much more susceptible to shame. But men, what we know is that a lot of violence in men is triggered by shame and humiliation, and that's not quite true with women. I don't think so. It's got a slightly different quality. I think that it can be triggered by guilt. I think that it can be triggered by sort of frustration. Guilt. I don't see it as triggered by shame.
So.
The shame is about being, humiliated and in front of the other. That's what shame is.
And so shame is a social emotion.
It's an internal one, and I think that I think that once again that it's much more internalised in women, and I think it comes out as guilt and other things. Whereas with men, it's all focused on the one who's shamed you. Not I am, with women it might be I am dirty or because of whatever happened, but the shame, the sense of being put down in front of the other.
They would never say,
Very complicated, you know. Many years ago I saw a woman and she had been sexually attacked and she was very brave. She'd gone out to court and was very serious. And she couldn't quite. And then it came out after several years of treatment that the only time in her life she'd had an orgasm was at that time. So how do you live with that? Even though she had a nice boyfriend. So that left her with terrible feelings, I think, of just confusion and upset. But it took her a long time thinking about that she'd be able to say that to me. And I suppose that's the closest to conclusion.
I think that's a very good place to stop. Cleo, thank you so much for that. It was absolutely riveting. And we need to have you back to talk more. But thank you. Now, let's all give Cleo a very good help.